is that they say the church is equal to the monarchy and we're going to treat them the exact same. And you have priests, Catholic priests, that are being executed as well because they're considered, remember, they're part of the first estate. They're considered the same as nobility. They're considered the same as monarchy. So if you're associated with the church, especially higher up, your head might come off too. Oh, that's a good question. So that's a major issue there, of course, with the Committee of Public Safety, making sure everyone's safe. And this is what I was just alluding to in answering Mrs. Ortel's question. The Jacobin Party, and specifically Robespierre, actually attempts to rewrite history much the way you see take place in Russia during the Communist Revolution. When Lenin comes to power, and this continues throughout Stalin's reign as a dictator in Russia as well, they are sponging out any history that does not look kindly upon the Communist Revolution. And the same thing is true of the Jacobin Party during this time, where they're trying to erase anything that gives any sort of credit or any sort of really just any information whatsoever about the monarchy itself. They want to do away with it. They change the calendar. So France is the only country in the short time that the revolutionary calendar is used. It's the only country that's operating that way. The days, I believe, are switched to 10-day weeks, which is to get rid of the idea of Sundays. So nobody really knows which day is Sunday, so you can't go to Mass. Most French are Catholic. And the first day of the week is, there is no quote-unquote weekend. It's a 10-day work week, and then it just kind of starts over. But you can imagine the logistical nightmare this is for the French people who are still doing business with other parts of the world, where their date is a completely made-up month that nobody else is honoring. It would be like it's kind of like in the United States when we have our daylight savings time, and the rest of the countries in the world go, "What do you mean? Like, you don't get an extra hour. You can't just change the time and go, oh, now it's 10 o'clock." In the United States, we're used to it, and we understand that it was, for actual daylight savings so that the time, would allow farmers and those in the factories more daylight to work. Anymore, it doesn't really do much for us. But that's sort of in a much more exponentially impactful way what's going on here. The French merchants are saying, the 5th of, I'm trying to think of one of the months. They all had weird names too. Of course, it's the French language. Everything sounds a little bit off. The 5th of such and such a month, that's when the delivery's coming in. And, the English merchant is going, the 5th of what? Like, it's the 14th of March. What do you mean you want it delivered at this time? So it's a complete overhaul of everything. And this leads to Robespierre's downfall because he has this massive celebration where they're celebrating this glorified idea of the revolution. And this does become the new religion in France, or at least what Robespierre is trying to promote, that the revolution is, well, incorruptible. And that's the nickname that's given to Robespierre. He's known as the incorruptible. And as leader of the revolution, anything that he decrees as head of the Committee of Public Safety has to be honored. And there's nothing wrong with it, and it's incorruptible, and you have to accept it. So the incorruptibility of the French Revolution, it was perfect, it was glorious, you have to worship it, you have to honor it. And the French people had just finally had enough. The majority of the French people are still not going to give up their Catholic beliefs that have been in their family for hundreds of years. Or the French Huguenots who are Protestant, they're just not simply going to do away with their religion either. So they finally overthrow Robespierre, and in a cruel twist of fate, he himself is actually beheaded by the guillotine. Part of the reason that we've already talked about the suspension of the rights of man, but that's another thing that happens under Robespierre that really leads to a lot of unrest among the French people. They have this revolution, they're granted voting rights and the right to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and of course that's not going to be the case if you can just be accused by the word of your neighbor. Say, so-and-so said something really bad about Maximilian Robespierre, you get hauled off to court, you get handed down the death penalty, and that's the end of it. So the death of Robespierre immediately leads to another dictatorship, Napoleon. And I don't want to spend too much time on this because I will get really, really deep into Napoleon, which I don't want to do. But ultimately, if you're looking at a lot of revolutions, the Russian Revolution, I've already mentioned this is a great example as well. You have the masses, the common people, the third estate, or the proletariat, if you will, in Russia, to use a Marxist term. You have the masses that rise up, they appoint their leaders, and they say, get rid of our monarchy. And the monarchy gets overthrown, and then in a short amount of time, everything goes back essentially to the way it was, where you don't have a representative government, you have very limited voting rights, poverty is not solved, people are still starving, and there's really just one person in power. And that's the hallmark of a bad revolution. That's not the type of revolution that actually promotes any change, because you're just saying, this person is bad, so let's replace him with another person. And it goes back to the saying, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. If you give somebody all the power, they're going to make a lot of mistakes, and it's probably going to corrupt them into believing that they're infallible or that they have power to control individual things about each of our lives. And so this is one of the points that I want to make in contrast here. In the United States, there was a lot of people calling for Washington to essentially be the dictator of the United States after the revolution. Now, my opinion of George Washington is very high. We probably would have excelled as a country with George Washington making a majority of the decisions simply because he was a really great man and he was a selfless person. But is there any guarantee that George Washington's, the person following him was going to be that good and we're going to give the next person that much power? Chances are, no, that probably wouldn't be the case. So the American Revolution is hallmarked by principle and legal procedure. And we're going to write a constitution, we're going to follow it, everybody accepts it once it's ratified, and this is how we operate. And that, for the most part, is how the entire American history is really written, is abiding by the letter of the law, the rule of law. Whereas a lot of other revolutions, they just kind of make it up as they go. You see that with the suspension of the rights of man. They say, this is law, but it's not really convenient for us right now, so we're going to do away with it. It doesn't happen in the United States. So to start our comparison, we're going to talk about the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were brought up last week. I think it was Dell that brought those up. He had a question about it. So John Adams' administration, John Adams is the second president of the United States. He comes to power 8 years after George Washington is sworn in as the first president. And during this time, there's a lot of unrest in the United States. There's a lot of newspapers and prominent politicians that are speaking out against the government that the Constitution has formed, believe it or not. And so Adams feels responsible for keeping the Constitution the law of the land and for, in the eyes of every other American, making sure that it stays legitimate. Because anytime there's any question about the legality or the legitimacy of the person in power or the law, then it's really just worth whatever it's written on, right? So, and this is a major issue with the 2020 election, where you have, I don't know what the percentage is, I've heard 40% of Americans believe that Biden didn't win the election. So what does that mean for every law that Biden signs? What does that mean for every executive order? And I'm not really even talking about whether or not he was legitimate, but when there's a question in the mind of that many people, the government can't operate, because then we'll just do whatever we want. And what's going to eventually have to result to make us honor the president or honor the rule of law force? And that's not really a point that Adams wanted to get. So he passes these Alien and Sedition Acts, which will imprison people for violently speaking out against the government. And everyone says, well, what about the First Amendment? That's exactly right. Adams' passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts end up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, according to the Bill of Rights, you can't imprison people for speaking out against the government. That's one of the things that we talked about when we founded the country, that you have to have that freedom. So Adams' intention is a good intention. He's trying to do the right thing, but the manner in which he's doing it is wrong. And that brings to mind a quote by Milton Friedman, which is, this won't be a direct quote, where he says a lot of bad government policy was written based on good intentions. You can have really good intentions, but your intention doesn't result always in good policy. And this is a perfect example of that. In the French Revolution, where you have a similar situation on a much larger scale with the suspension of the rights of man, that's allowed to simply pass through. And the French people have to live years with their legal rights being suspended by the Committee of Public Safety and Robespierre. So this is the good part of America, in the sense that when it happens on a small scale here, it goes to the Supreme Court and the process works exactly like it's supposed to. The Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional. That law cannot continue to be on the books. And we give a massive thumbs up because we go, yeah, this works. What we're doing is working, and John Jay and the rest of the Supreme Court give us that great example of that. The other thing is the treatment of loyalist Americans. And I had to do some research on this, but there's just kind of pockets of loyalist Americans. So those Americans that were continuing to be loyal to King George III, and those who supported the American Revolution. You would think after the Treaty of Paris in 1781, what happens? Because there's a lot of Americans that still support England. But we don't hear very much about any violence that's being exacted or revenge that the United States government is going to seeking out these traitors, which is exactly what happens in the French Revolution during the Reign of Terror. We have to seek out all the people who disagreed with the French Revolution, and we have to kill them, or else our revolution may not last. Never really happens in the United States. You have kind of roving gangs, especially in the southern United States, and they may attack other loyalist gangs, and loyalist gangs may attack patriot gangs, if you will. But there's nothing that's really formally organized, and there's nothing that's being supported by any American governments to say, let's go after these people who didn't support, they're American, but they're loyalist Americans. Let's get some revenge on them. Let's imprison them. Let's take away their rights. And a great example of sort of this American idea post-war, and you see this in just about every war that the United States has ever fought. We win, and then we're not sore winners, if you understand what that means. It's not like we're going to rub your face in it. After the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln has a 10% plan. And it's unfortunate that he's assassinated, because this is a very, very great plan. Lincoln did not want to rub the South's face in the fact that they lost the Civil War. That was the opposite. He said, that would not heal the nation. That would not progress us. We won. The United States has kept its union. Now let's move on. So he was only going to require 10% of a Southern state to swear allegiance to the United States government, to be admitted back into the Union, and to have their senators and congressmen given back to them. Only 10%. If you look at the Americans and their treatment of Japan after World War II, helped rebuild the country. You look at the Marshall Plan in Europe after World War II. The Americans did not try to rub the Germans' face in the fact that, you know, we're occupying Berlin. What happens in East Germany after World War II? The United States allows the German people to run their own country. Immediately, this is like 1946, and the Americans are like, no, representative government. We're already trusting you with the democratic process because that's how much we believe in it. This isn't going to be a military occupation like it was in East Germany with the Russians. So the treatment of loyalist Americans after the American Revolution really sets a tone for how the United States is going to operate. A lot of these loyalist Americans leave, and they're allowed to leave. But some of them stay, some of them go to Canada, and for the most part, there's no systemic seeking out of these loyalists and say, oh, we gotta root you out, and we gotta find you and kill you or imprison you. Not a lot of treason charges post-Revolutionary War. There's really not a lot of treason charges in the history of the United States. The Rosenbergs? back in the 1950s. I think I got their name right. Husband and wife, they were accused of treason. That's a huge deal in the United States, because if you get accused of treason in the U.S., that's way more than front page news. That's something that only happens a couple times a century in American history. And I think this is interesting because treason charges in the French Revolution abound everywhere. Everyone's a traitor in one way or the other. Even in their thoughts, you could be considered a traitor. And as soon as you verbalize those, and we can say this person spoke out against the French Revolution, well, now you can not only be imprisoned for it, but you can just be killed. Whereas in the United States, we don't really like to accuse people of treason because of your constitutional rights, your freedom of speech, and so forth. So that label traitor is not really thrown around a lot in the United States, because you can have a lot of different opinions about the government and still be considered a loyal American. Rule of law in the United States, as opposed to mob rule, is a big difference. And something that I've already mentioned, but in the United States, rule of law is paramount. It's not a person that's in charge, it's not an organization that is charged, it's not a political party, it is the Constitution. And once it's written and once it's ratified by the actual legal process, then everyone has to accept that. And so if there's any question to, you know, the actual basis of the Constitution and whether or not it's legitimate, well, there's going to be issues. But for the most part, as Americans, we accept the rule of law. We accept written law in our everyday lives, and that's how we operate, even if we disagree with it, which is fascinating as Americans that, you know, our society hasn't descended to mob rule or anarchy, because we do have so many freedoms, right? But we say, oh, I disagree with this law, but I understand the process by which it passed was legal, and so I'm going to honor it. Nobody likes to pay taxes, and yet we file our taxes every year. Hopefully you do. Don't tell me if you don't. I'm not going to be a witness in your IRS trial. So ultimately, and this just kind of sums up the whole thing, one revolution was staged by those defending the law in the United States. The other is staged by those breaking the law. So you can't just label something revolution. And as Americans, we really want to do this. Whenever we hear revolution that's happening in Cuba right now, we want to go, oh, yes, we support that. Overthrow that terrible government. Right? Was the Tsarist government in Russia bad? Sure it was. But was the communist revolution good? No. Was Louis XVI a terrible king? Yes. But was revolution in this case good? No. Okay, so we have to be extremely picky about how we even identify revolution. And the American Revolution is rooted in the law. It happened over a period of several years. Peace was always pursued. It was always preferred over violence, something you don't always see in a lot of other revolutions, actually rarely see in other revolutions. Violence seems to be the first thing that people go after. So hopefully that gives you sort of a bird's eye view of the French Revolution and helps us with comparisons. And actually I have about 15 minutes or so, maybe a little bit more, for our discussion time. So I think I still have your questions, Larry. He gave me two questions, so we're going to start with his questions, and I told him he did his homework, so I'm going to pay him back for them. So the first question, I'm just going to read it so everybody can hear it, and then if you need to change it at all, like you want to make it more specific, then you can. But the first one he has written down here, explain again why the Bill of Rights was such an important document. So the Bill of Rights is important, and we're seeing this across Europe, especially, because the Bill of Rights is kind of an untouchable list of things that every American possesses. And I think the greatest example of that is probably the Second Amendment. You have a lot of people that want to attack and infringe upon the Second Amendment, but even liberal courts have judges who understand the rule of law and understand the Bill of Rights, and they say, unless there is a legal precedent or a legal avenue to actually change the Second Amendment, people have the right to own guns. it just exists. Look at other countries like Australia. New Zealand is a great example too. So this is a Western civilization based on democracy. They had a mandatory government buyback program where people had to give up their guns. And it was legally passed. That law was passed by their democratic government. So you say, well, should they give up their guns? Legally speaking, they should, because the law was passed. And, you know, there's no funny business about it. But in the United States, you can't pass that law. So the Bill of Rights is awesome, because it's saying, here are a list of over 10 things, but it's 10 amendments. You go, you cannot pass any laws that infringe upon these rights. And it's a list, and it's there in black and white. And that's why it's so important. If you look at what's happening in London with freedom of speech, it's awful. You know, you can get arrested for hate speech. And hate speech can be whatever the person that your speech was directed toward defines it as. In the United States, that's an infringement of the First Amendment. And hate speech has this terrible ambiguity to it. And so most of the time in the United States, you're not going to be able to convict somebody based on hate speech because of their First Amendment rights. So I hope that answers your question. And then the second question, what would you suggest should be done today to communicate the religious liberty guaranteed in the Bill of Rights? So communicate on a like public scale. Well, the most important thing, in my estimation, with our rights that are lined up in the Constitution is the practicing of those rights. So the most important thing that you can do publicly to continue to possess your freedom of religion is to continue to come to church. Because once people stop exercising their rights, then it doesn't really matter to them whether or not they have them. So if gun sales and ammunition sales suddenly plummeted, would we really care all that much if they banned assault rifles or rifles of certain caliber or magazines? That we wouldn't, because we're not exercising those rights. So I would say that'd be the most important thing. The other thing would just be probably just historical knowledge of the United States, because most people don't know about the United States history. And freedom of religion is coupled with this idea of the separation of church and state, but people don't even know what that means. It's not that religious ideas should be separated from government, because then we wouldn't have "In God We Trust" on our currency, and we wouldn't have a history of having, I don't know how many courthouses still have the Ten Commandments, but you know, in the House of Congress, you still have, you know, that painting of Moses. And you think, well, that's separation of church and state. No, what's that separating is the state coming into a church and saying, you can't preach this, you can't preach that. So I think understanding that difference would also be an important way to communicate that freedom of religion. What I believe, personally, is really of no consequence to anyone else. So if now when I start acting on those beliefs, that's where it gets a little bit more murky. But do Christians believe in open violence against anyone or any group? Do Christians go seek out people to force them into conversion? No, we don't believe any of that. So again, analyzing the Constitution and then analyzing the Word of God and saying, there's nothing here that prevents me from exercising my religion. And any action that Jesus tells me to take has really no consequence to you in making you do anything. I show up to church, I may share something with you from my devotions, I may talk to you about Jesus, but I'm not forcing you to do anything. And if you feel uncomfortable, you can leave. That's individual liberty. My beliefs are really of no consequence to you. Now, if you get into, you know, more aggressive conversion, you know, religions that force people, well, of course, that's going to go against the U.S. Constitution. And so you would say, in that case, if you can find a Christian religion that does that, or, you know, maybe extremist Muslim who believes in that, then, yeah, that exercise of religion would be incorrect. If you want to force someone to be a human sacrifice for your religion, that doesn't count. Because now you're taking that person's rights away, and your rights don't supersede anyone else's. So I practice my religion, and we practice our religion here in this building, but it's not endangering anyone else out there. I mean, we're in a neighborhood, for crying out loud, and nobody's in danger here. Yes. Please do. Oh, you can't play devil's advocate in a church, though, can you?
At a certain point, like with the French Revolution, talking and being nice and reasoning doesn't get you anywhere. So what should we be looking for, like, now to let us know that we're maybe at that point? Or do you think that that's just not ever appropriate, the way they responded?
The way the French responded? The way the French responded in the first part of the French Revolution, I would say is correct in saying we have a bad king, our government isn't working. What are the legal avenues that are in place currently that we can change that? And I think I mentioned last week, if the French would have stormed their way into the Estates General and forced the first two estates to listen to them, they would have had a legal standing for that. So what I would say is you have to look at the American Revolution to answer that question more so than the French Revolution, because when did the American Revolution become violent? It's not a rhetorical question I want an answer. You'd say Lexington and Concord as an actual I'm going to shoot at you type of violence. There's tarring and feathering, and there's the Boston Massacre, but let's say Lexington and Concord. And I've established, I hope, in your minds, that was right for the Americans to defend themselves. So I would say if someone comes to your property and says, we are forcing you to do something that they do not have legal support for, at that point, you would, according to American law, you would have the right to use force on them because they're trespassing and they're acting in an illegal way that's threatening you. And that's built into American law currently. So if somebody breaks into your house and you feel that there's a threat to your life or the lives of the other members of your household, you have the right to use deadly force against that person. And so even if it's a government official, and it's a scary thing to say, but if there's a government official that is trespassing, acting in an illegal way, and threatening your life or the life of your family or the people that are on your property, then you have a right to use force to defend yourself against that. And I say that specifically, and I try to be as specific as possible, because I don't want you guys to think that the American Revolution is revolutionaries going out to seek conflict. If there's a BLM rally in Denver or Boulder, I'm not going to show up with my AR and try to instigate something, because then who's the problem? Me. Now, if there's a Black Lives Matter rally, this would never happen, in Kersey, and they're marching down 2nd Street, they're trespassing on my property, and they have Molotov cocktails, and they're shouting obscenities at my wife, you better believe that I'm going to do something about that. Because you're on my property, you're the instigator, you're the aggressor, I'm acting in defense of my property and my family. Much different scenario. Lexington and Concord is that exact situation. The Minutemen did not march into Boston and pick a fight with the Redcoats. The Redcoats marched into the Massachusetts countryside to pick a fight with the Minutemen. Okay, and I think Pastor is going to kind of root that out in his explanation of self-defense as well. So that's going to be very interesting. But I'm just answering that based on a legal point of view. So if you want the biblical point of view, you'll have to talk to him. You had your hand up, and then Mr. Pryor, and then Don.
Well, part of I'm going to answer some of this is there's in this state alone, since I've lived here, there have been numerous people taking people to court for what's called the Make My Game Law. Okay, and people who have shot and killed people who were intruding in their property were vindicated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think some states have stand your ground laws as well, which I think is a little bit different. I think that is more if you're out and on public property or property that's not yours. That one that you're talking about is probably if you're on your property. So just to kind of clarify that, a lot of people have heard of those stand your ground laws. I think that's more, it might apply to private property, but I think it more applies to outside of your.
We had an incident when I was a kid, and that was a stand your ground type situation where we had a guy on a horse who was herding cattle through our yard, came up and threatened us. And as bad as it sounds, we went into the house. He was still there.
Good.
But that would have, because he was on our ground, and even if it were on public ground.
He was the aggressor in that situation.
Yes, and he had a little bit of damage. He had actually injured some of our animals. But he was saying he was going to do the same to us. You know, and when you have that, and once again, that's a legal thing. He tried to take us to court because we got him.
Yeah, no, I think that would probably, that would, totally vindicated in that situation. Mr. Pryor?
Based on something that Mike asked me on my own last week, rather than comparing U.S. and French Revolution, I see a bit of a contrast because the French were not rebelling against another country they felt was necessarily ruling over them. They were fighting against themselves. And so it's almost, while I think it best compared to the Russian Revolution, it's almost similar to the American Civil War if the Confederates were trying to take over rather than just secede from the Union. I don't know if that makes sense, but
I understand.
That might have to
That's a So you can't let geography get in the way of society, because the Americans did not consider themselves different than British. So because they were British citizens, they were just basically living in a different place. It'd be like the difference between New Yorkers and Californians in their mind. They would associate themselves with the colonies, but they would also associate themselves with the whole of being a British subject and a citizen to the king. So I think that there's a little bit more of a geographical difference because there's an ocean between them that lends us to think of the idea that the English were kind of a different country and we're fighting this kind of faraway idea of people. But that's not how the colonists viewed it. They actually did think about it as fighting their own countrymen a little bit more so. And it's not until after the United States becomes independent that you have them identifying themselves specifically as Americans. Now, they're American colonists prior to the revolution, but not so much like a different country. So hopefully that clears it up. Mr. Brazelton, and then Paul, your question will be last. Misinformation.
So what I'm asking is
So I, we're going to go late. So I think a good example of this, at least from the private business side of things, is the ideas of Barry Goldwater, who was a Republican presidential candidate back in the 1960s. So this is during the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King Jr. And part of the reason that Barry Goldwater did not win the presidential election was because of his stance on racism in the United States. He actually believed that businesses should have the right to refuse service to somebody based on their race, that the Constitution actually protected that, and that businesses were individual entities. So the business should be treated as an individual in the eyes of the Constitution. And as I pointed out several times, it's not illegal in the United States to be racist. You can hold those beliefs personally. It is, currently in the United States, it is illegal to for a business to refuse service based on gender, race, religion, etc. So what I would say is that you have to be very careful, and I hope this isn't a non-answer, but you have to be very careful in the government ever limiting what a business can and can't do. Barry Goldwater believed that eventually American society and the free market would eradicate those businesses and organizations that were racist. And that if the government came into a business and said, you can't refuse service, that down the road there would be issues. And how much do we see that happening with the baker down in Denver? It's all over now. Because you can't refuse service to me because you're a private business. So what that applies in my idea to like Twitter's a private company. And so if it would like to refuse anyone the use of its platform, personally, I would think that it would be protected to do so. The rub comes in what you pointed out, in where that organization is, in fact, infringing upon someone else's constitutional rights. Because in that case, a business cannot do that. So an organization, a business that disagreed with Westside Baptist Church could not come in and try to shut us down, because they would be infringing upon our First Amendment rights to practice our religion. So I think I would have to look at all of the evidence, and I would have to give you a better answer, because I really don't know what the answer is. Because personally, I would love to support a business's ability to decide who it serves and who it doesn't, because I think that businesses are individual rather than an organization. But I also can see how President Trump's First Amendment rights are being infringed by big tech. That's correct. The Constitution doesn't give him the power to declare what's misinformation and what's not. Yeah. And I think what that goes back to is what Larry asked about, is what would be the best way to communicate your liberties in that situation? Ignore it. You know, if you get censored off of Facebook, petition Facebook, there's legal avenues right now afforded to Americans to pursue that. So, you can't just declare something misinformation and then say, well, you can't talk about it now.
Mm-hmm. And I got a note from Facebook while we were in tech, saying that they weren't going to send it and they were going to put me in internet jail for 30 days.
And that in and of itself is kind of questionable, right? Do you have the right to a fair trial in that situation? So as these companies get bigger and bigger, it seems as though they're operating outside of the bounds of the Constitution. And that, again, is another issue. It'd be fascinating to wonder what the founders would think of that. Because these tech groups are so massive that I mean, they're passing judgment on you, but you don't get a trial, you don't get representation, you don't get any of the things that as an American citizen, you're guaranteed. So in that way, you go, well, a government, you're operating as a government. You can't operate as a government. You're just a business. So take him to court. Paul, and then very quickly, and then we have to close.
I really enjoyed your evaluation of the Bill of Rights, but if I could just seriously ask for, we're facing this on a daily basis almost, and I've got a staff meeting scheduled for Wednesday in which we're going to determine that we're not going to take any outside business because we're faced with doing so much business with government now that if they come in and start forcing us to service the LGBTQ people, we're going to stand for our rights, mm-hmm. we're going to stand for the truth, but just the situation of going to court and proving that we have the right to serve whom we wish to serve will put us out of business.
Sure.
And, you know, of course, I trust the Lord, and it's his business in the first place, but mm-hmm. we are facing it, folks, and it's coming. Most people here have not felt it yet. I'm feeling the pressure on my shoulders right now. It's coming, and it's coming.
Yep.
Mark.
Yeah. And as a teacher, I know somewhat.
You're in it too.
Yeah, just because of my relationship with government, mm-hmm. local, state, and federal. And one thing I would just encourage everybody, based on Paul's comment there, is what I've said several times. Your actions are your own. And if someone can tell you to do something, I tell this to my students all the time. They say, well, I can't do that. It's not like I can just walk out of the classroom and just leave. I don't want to be here. I say, yes, you can. You can leave whenever you want. You can leave this classroom. You can walk out of the school. You can start walking down the road into Keensburg and get yourself an energy drink. You can walk back. You can go out on the lam. You can hop onto a train and get your way to New York. I said, you can do whatever you want, but are you prepared to deal with the ramifications of those actions? So don't ever tell me I can't do this or I can't say that or I can't. You can do whatever you want, but are you prepared to deal with the ramifications of those actions? So when somebody, you know, was to come to your door and say, you have to get vaccinated, you said, no, I don't. Well, we're going to call the police. Then call the police. We're going to arrest you. Then arrest me. I'm not getting vaccinated. Or, you know, really anything. You can't preach anymore. Says who? Says me. Okay, so do something about it. Well, we're going to call the cops. Then call the cops. You see, like a lot of us don't want to deal with the ramifications of doing what we think is right. But at some point, you have to either call their bluff or deal with the ramifications of doing the right thing. And so if somebody says, you have to do this, and what happens if I don't? Because now you have to make sure that you actually have legal standing to do that, right? That in the eyes of God, you're actually acting in the way that you should. But people got arrested in Soviet Russia for being Christians all the time. Are you prepared to do that? And one thing that's a comfort to me is that laws can be passed and presidents can decree and things can change in this country, but the one thing that's not going to change is me. It's not going to change. The word of God's not going to change. He's still on his throne, and what I do in my house is always going to be the same, regardless of who's at my door, because what I believe is right, and I know that because of what the Bible says.
Amen.
So let me just encourage you guys with that. A lot of times we get so discouraged, right, with what happens. Well, they're going to pass this law. What happens if this happens? Continue to do the right thing. That's what.
Amen.
That's what. And I promise, as long as you're at Westside Baptist Church, that's how Pastor Edward is going to lead this church. Laws can be passed, but Westside Baptist will always be a Bible-believing, fundamental church. And so I find a lot of encouragement in that. And I hope this series has been encouraging to you as well. I'm sorry that we're late this morning, but that was some good discussion. So let's pray, and then I really look forward to hearing what Pastor talks about next week.